Eileen Duncan, welcome back to Cheological.
Thank you, Michael.
That was such a fun conversation that we had a month or two back.
Sure was.
It has shifted how I look at things in my clinic, because now there are certain people that come in and they look a certain way or they act a certain way. And whereas before I would have not thought about, oh, I think there's some trauma in the background. Now I look at them and I go, okay, there's something here. I don't know what it is, but I suspect there is something here, and it has just given me like a spider sense for things.
I think as soon as we put the right glasses on, we can see things that we didn't see before, and you know, when you're looking through this more subtle or more nuanced lens, you just start to see things that are just so very helpful to see. Because trauma does kind of two things, or in an acupuncturist's office. It either is invisible and we don't see it and we don't treat it, or we do attempt to treat it and we blow people out of the water. We over-treat it. We either under-treat it or we over-treat it. So when you develop some eyes to see what's there, you're more able to meet the person where they need to be met instead of being ineffective or being over the top.
Or actually cause harm.
Potentially. Yeah. I mean, I think more of the harm we might cause is that our needling becomes really uncomfortable because a person's so braced and tight, they can't receive the needle without, you know, pain. Mostly people will equilibrate in a day or two with over-treatment. You know, I don't think we're going to hurt somebody in the long term, but we're not going to be as helpful as we could be.
Well, I know that I had a patient a little while back, and she wanted some cupping. She gets into my office, and I said, you know, how are you? What are you here for? She goes, well, I think I'm here for cupping. And I'm like, what? You think you're here for cupping? It's like, what are you doing in my mind, right? What are you doing here?
Right.
She didn't even know what she wanted. And there was this kind of vacancy in her eyes, and there was just this timidness about her. And I this was before I had this conversation with you.
Right.
So when things are really, when they're really there, you can kind of sense it. You may not know what you're sensing, but it's just like, okay, be careful, be cautious.
Right.
And I remember treating her super gently for some shoulder stuff. And even with some very gentle needling, it just seemed like, oh, this might have been too much. And because she had come in and she really wanted cupping, I thought I would do some very gentle, just like super soft, a little gliding fire cupping. You know, people love that, right? You put oil on their back.
And I know. It feels
some nice
good.
Hot cup. And you just, right? And I put a cup on her back, and she like writhed up off the table. And I thought, oh man, I don't know what I have going on here, but you know, I super backed off, did a little bit more cupping, super backed off. And she calls me the next day and says, is it possible that acupuncture could give me the flu? And actually, she left a message on my voice machine. And by the time I got back to her, she said, yes, I've been to the doctor, and the doctor confirmed that I've got the flu. But in my mind, I'm thinking, yep, you got the flu. Something happened.
Right.
And now you've got the flu.
Right.
Because I did not treat you gently enough.
Hate it when that happens.
Yeah.
I'm remembering a patient who called me and wanted to schedule an appointment and for knee pain. And he was referred by a therapist who had referred many patients to me. And so, you know, and meanwhile, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, how boring is knee pain? I mean, knee, you know, like, what? Really? You know,
yeah.
You know? But okay, I'll take you because of, you know, who's being referred. Well, it turned out this guy had such significant dynamics of attachment. Mm-hmm. He had to bring his closest attachment source were two stuffed animals that he brought with him to treatment.
Oh,
and,
wow.
And had to like have them on his chest while I treated him in order to feel safe and comfortable to be treated. Mm-hmm. So you never really know what's walking in your door. You know, like no, what's the ticket for admission? Like a person can say I have knee pain and not have any, you know, particular shame about it or challenge to walk in. But some other things might be harder to say out loud that this is why I need help. You know,
I find this is true so often. Mm-hmm. It's the knee pain that brings them in, or the back pain, or right. the
allergies, you know, the, whatever.
Yeah, the thing that's like socially acceptable that's to go right. see a, you know, air quotes here, a doctor for.
That's right.
And then you start getting into some stuff, and this whole other part can unwind if the space is safe.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. That's the foundational thing, is to create safety mm-hmm. in relationship.
Mm-hmm. Now, with the guy walking in with two stuffed animals, mm-hmm. you would know immediately, whoop, okay, not your average case of knee pain.
Right.
You know, this woman right. who came in to me for cupping, I was savvy enough to go, all right, something else is up here, and be cautious. Right. Those are pretty gross circumstances.
Right.
And I think pretty much any of us that's been at this for a period of time would catch that.
Right.
What about the kinds of cases where it's not so overt, uh-huh. right? It's not so notable. And if we didn't know to pay attention, we could easily miss it.
Right.
Here's some things to watch for that might tip us off a little bit sooner.
Right. I mean, I don't think he brought his stuffed animals out maybe for the first few sessions. Mm. You know, it took questions like, what helps you cope with this?
Oh,
who's okay. there for you? If you could feel just like how you'd like to feel, where would you be? What would you be doing? To sort of windows into his day-to-day life that, and a sense of safety with me and non-judgment and, you know, so forth and so on, that then he could say, well, would it be okay if I brought so-and-so and so-and-so out of my bag?
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I asked a fellow, a veteran once, what helped him cope when he was in Iraq. He had a pet cockroach.
Wow.
He had a pet cockroach that lived in the crack of the bricks. And he would come back home to his cockroach and say hello. He had somebody to something. To say hello to. Mm-hmm. And that's what kept him going while he was there. So it's a fabulous question. What helps you cope? And
yeah.
and who's there for you? Mm-hmm. are fabulous ways of finding out what is the capacity for relationship and connection, and what's the community of support this person is living in. And we're tribal animals, so we need to have a tribe around us. And who's their tribe? And yeah. what's their relationship to the tribe, and how do they fit in with the tribe, and what do they give and what do they receive? And
I remember this from our previous conversation, has really stuck with me mm-hmm. about the importance of the social connection. That's what right. kind it is it supportive, or yeah. what kind is it not supportive?
Yeah.
And just how critical that context mm-hmm. around us mm-hmm. allows something to come out or to go further in.
That's right. Exactly right. Does it come out, or does it go further in? Mm-hmm. And that's really, in our terms, a statement of the strength of the Shen, the strength of the heart spirit to be the heart protector, you know, to be protecting, to close the gates and open the gates, and all those images that come from our tradition.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I am curious about, and I'd like to get into a little bit, and this comes from a patient that I recently got, oddly enough, after our previous shortly after our previous conversation. uh-huh. It was extraordinary.
Yeah. Synchronicity.
Yeah, this guy comes in and like one of the first things he tells me is how he really shouldn't be here. He had, you know, as an infant, there were some serious issues. He spent a lot of time with surgeries, incubator. His esophagus didn't quite reach his stomach. They had to like reattach all kinds of stuff. And it, again, because I'd been a little bit clued in from our previous conversation, to be able to recognize that, oh my goodness, from that very early, earliest moments in this world, it has been extremely unsafe and difficult and painful. And
that's right.
And, you know, I'm looking at this guy who's now in his 30s and thinking, what kind of magic have you been able to pull out of your hat to be here?
Right, right, right. Because that first imprint of, I feel like I'm going to die. That was his first imprint. I feel like I'm going to die. And the threat, the sense of threat was coming from inside his own body.
Mm-hmm.
So his body wasn't a safe place to inhabit. That's a pretty profound imprint.
Yes.
To carry. Yep.
So I remember from our conversation, from having read the book, it just seemed like before I did any needles, the first thing I wanted to do was just kind of sit and feel what was going on. Right. And this guy was like open to it. So that was cool. Right. Great. Sometimes people are not. They're like, what? What are you doing?
Right. Yeah.
But he was good with it. And so I just slid my hand under his kidneys.
Good. Yeah.
Seemed like a good place to start.
Yeah.
Right?
Perfect.
And just kind of hung out there for a while. Just see what I felt.
Perfect.
You know, just see, does the breath come down here? Does it not come down here? Is the tissue tight? Is the tissue not tight?
That's right.
And it just kind of waited till it kind of softened up a little.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you start to feel a pulse of any kind in the kidney?
I cannot recall if I felt a pulse. I often will listen for a cranial rhythm on occasion. I can feel that. And so if I feel the tissues opening and suppling and, and that there's breath and vitality coming into the tissue, I take that as a good sign. I don't remember if there was a pulse, but I have felt pulses when I've done that kind of work before.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, some ideally, you know, when the kidney adrenal system, which I think of as one system, it's in one fascial sac, the kidney and the adrenal gland. That's from The Spark and the Machine. It talks about that. That when it feels afraid, when the adrenal feels afraid, it lifts up and gets braced, and the whole kidney gets hard and tight because it's braced. So as it gets some loving attention, some warmth, some compassion, some safety, and starts to sink down, that push against the diaphragm, like it's lifted up against the diaphragm. So as it softens that connection, the diaphragm will allow breath to move more fluidly. So they'll often take a deep breath and the kidney becomes more infused with blood. So you'll actually be able to feel a pulse or movement or I'm sure, or cranial rhythm, you know, in that organ as it sinks and actually falls into your hand. And what you're doing is you're shifting the neurological platform, that's Stephen Porges's term, that that person is working from. Because when they're in that high arousal, fight, flight, kidney braced, adrenal slammed, there's a very limited range of human behaviors that you can manifest. You have to be a little bit on the rigid side. You have to be a little bit on the black and white thinking. You have to be a little bit, you're consuming your jing, to use our language. You're consuming the precious substance of the jing. Your morbidity and mortality is being profoundly affected. Your lifelong health is affected. It's not good.
Yeah. So you've got a narrower bandwidth just in terms of response.
Narrower. That's right. That's right. That's
and right. It's the same time you're like sucking on your reserves because you're constant. Just in overdrive.
Right.
You got one foot on the brakes and another one on the gas.
Right. What was his sort of capacity for connection with you or his conversations about family relationships, friendships, stuff like that?
Pretty good. He was cognizant of his situation in many ways.
Uh-huh.
And especially when I spoke it out, oh my goodness, you've been living with this kind of trauma for ever. He was like, yeah.
Uh-huh. He felt understood and seen by you.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things I did very early on was say, well, this is, I'm trying to remember what he even came in with.
Right. Knee pain.
You know, yeah. I am totally blanking on what he came in. It might have been anxiety, but I can't remember.
Yeah.
And, but just being able to vocalize to him and say, oh, well, this is a part of the picture here. This is a part of what we will work on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he just seemed like, yeah, that made sense. He was all in to be recognized.
Right.
And quickly.
Right.
I mean, on occasion, I think it was, I was just lucky because I'd been talking to you.
Mm-hmm.
And so he came in and I was alert to it. Right. I would have not brought the trauma of his birth circumstances into it if we hadn't had that conversation. Exactly. I would have missed it completely.
Right. So what happened to him is that he came in, there was a basis for threat. His organs weren't connected right. He was whatever all, you know, he was premature, he was C-section, he was whatever it was that was happening. He had a sense of threat. He didn't have I'm going to get into polyvagal theory.
that polyvagal is cool.
It's very cool. So when we're born, we only have enough of our ventral vagus, which is the part of the vagus nerve that innervates above the diaphragm. It's essentially, in our language, it's the shen, also involves the breath. So it's that upper chamber of the upper jaw. We only have enough capacity there to suckle, to make a connection for nursing. It will develop rapidly in the first 6 months of life and continue to develop until we're into our teens. But it will only develop if we have co-regulatory relationship with a loving caregiver.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's been so unavailable because of this threat at birth, it's going to be even harder for him to manifest the regulation of the heart. Because instead of being able to be soothed, he had to use his dorsal vagus from the back of the brainstem in order to mitigate his cardiac arousal. So his heart sent a message to the whole kingdom of his body: life threat, life danger. Send out all the fire trucks. We need all of you. I'm going to die. You know, like that. And continues to beat rapidly and send out that message, but his body could only tolerate that message for so long because his heart could beat out of his chest. Like, you can only tolerate 180 or 200 beats per minute, even when you're a baby, for so long.
Right. Well, and not to mention, he's a baby and he has zero experience in this world.
That's right. That's right.
His nervous system is blank.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, not exactly, because his nervous system knew exactly what to do. His nervous system called out his dorsal vagus nerve and said, slow down, heart. You can't keep this up and still live, so we're going to slow you down.
Mm.
And that was life-saving for him, but it meant that there was a dominance of his dorsal vagus nerve overpowering his ventral vagus nerve.
Mm-hmm.
And so his heart didn't get a chance to develop its function as the supreme controller. Because
it's been down-regulated by the dorsal vagus nerve.
That's right. It's been down-regulated by this really ponderous, clumsy, big, big foot standing on the heart in order to save its life.
Mm-hmm. So.
So then when you.
Mm-hmm.
Hold his kidney, you're reminding his nervous system that there's another way to be, that don't have to live with high arousal in the kidney adrenal system all the time. In fact, you can experience safety.
Mm-hmm.
You can operate from a different neurological platform. You can operate from a platform that includes low arousal, low dorsal vagus, that can allow the ventral vagus to cultivate and emerge.
Now, I've got a question about this. This happened for this fellow at a super tender age, right? Yeah. This happened from birth. Mm-hmm. Now, I get what you're saying, and I'm just trying to wrap my brain around it here, so just hang with me while I noodle through this.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I can see someone having, I'm going to call it like normalish life in the beginning,
mm-hmm.
and then something happens, they go into this arousal, dorsal vagus comes in, they shut it down. Now they're living this sort of compromised existence in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
But they had something before that.
That's right.
To come back to, right? So when you hold their kidneys, it's like, oh, I felt like I was 7 again or something, right? Because maybe that was the last time they'd felt it.
Right.
For someone like this who has managed to, you know, live this life, but has always been under the influence like this, is it different? Or are there other things to watch out for or to be attentive to when someone from the get-go has had this kind of a regulatory influence on their heart?
You're going to be surprised as you continue to look through these glasses,
mm.
how many people in your practice have something similar to what this fellow had.
Mm.
That it's the people who had early trauma in their lives that later develop the kinds of symptoms that come to acupuncture. Autoimmune illness, chronic headaches, irritable bowel, metabolic disorder, hypertension, anxiety, cancer. Like, all those things can be traced to the quality of disorganization that happens with early trauma. And the rates of those kinds of illnesses, drug addiction, obesity, the rates of people who experience early trauma are like 400, 500, 600% more with who develop those kinds of symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
And it's those strange, rare, and peculiar things that people come to acupuncture for. They don't come to us for needing an appendectomy, something straightforward and let's take care of it, or a broken limb. Mm-hmm. You know, they come to us for healing their energy field, bringing regulation to their energy field.
And issues that they've probably already been to conventional medicine and it either didn't help or it hurt.
That's right. That's right. That's mm-hmm. right. That's
so... All right. Well, this rabbit hole really goes deep then. I mean, I feel super fortunate that I had this guy, you know, super obvious
mm-hmm.
case. What I'm hearing you say is people with autoimmune diseases, people with certain digestive mm-hmm. issues, mm-hmm. Chronic kinds of issues. These are indicators that we might want to be attentive to very, very early trauma.
That's right. That's right. Although, I'm going to throw in a wrench into the monkey works here.
A wrench into the monkey works, great.
There's also some very interesting research on what's called epigenetics.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, in Israel, there's been a lot of research on children and grandchildren of Holocaust survivors. The Netherlands, there was some fabulous research on what they called the Dutch famine winter, where... women who were pregnant during the famine of World War II delivered babies that were smaller in size than previous generations and had higher rates of schizophrenia and obesity. Mm-hmm. And what they found out was that their children, so the grandchildren, whose mothers did not experience famine in their pregnancy, they also had higher rates of mental illness and obesity and some of these other problems. So there are genetic changes that that can happen as a result of trauma. And so it could be that your patient didn't themselves experience this level of stress, but maybe their parent or their grandparent or their great-grandparent did. And it's affecting their genetic manifestation of their autonomic nervous system.
You know, I think that's spot on because as we're having the conversation here right now, I am recalling that his family situation was very, very difficult.
Uh-huh.
So that family situation didn't get difficult all by itself.
Right.
There's usually a lineage
Right.
That comes right. down that way. Right. So I suspect he's dealing with both.
Right. So then there's the question, like, does a person develop this kind of dysregulation because their parents were dysregulated, or do they get this kind of dysregulation because of birth trauma, or is it nature or is it nurture?
You know. Or did it come from the grandparents?
Right.
Yeah.
Now, there's some fascinating research that was just published in the current issue of Science magazine on epigenetics. This scientist is studying mice because they have more rapid generational, you know, they turn over their generations more rapidly than humans do.
Yes.
So she's gone down six generations and she's tormented the mice. You know, she's thrown them in water and she's loud noises and all kinds of stuff. And their pups show autonomic nervous system dysregulation. They're wiggy, you know. And she's done this six generations and with lots of cross breeding and all that kind of stuff, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and demonstrated that the pups inherit the dysregulation. But here's the great thing. She's also put some of these pups in the equivalent of a palace with spa services 24/7. I mean, she's like given them opportunities for healing and for safety and good food and all that. And their pups do not show the trauma.
Wow. Send the mice to the Mouse Canyon Ranch.
That's right. So what we're doing to restore regulation in our patients is, I have goosebumps,
yeah,
is affecting
too.
Generations to come.
That really shifts the frame for me. Mm-hmm. You know, I want to get into this more about how we can help our patients, you know, in mm-hmm. these moments. Mm-hmm. And recognizing that the work we do, which helps people now, actually can make for a different world down the way, because their offspring,
that's right,
will come in with a whole different, maybe not a whole different, but a different genetic endowment.
And it's even bigger than that, Michael.
It's even bigger.
Because think of the person who's like got a shut down brainstem with a strong dorsal vagus control. And they, because that's so powerful back there, it's taken the frontal cortex hostage. Mm-hmm. They don't really have access to the thoughtful part of their brain. They're really more in that, is it a rope or a snake conversation. And what happens when you help loosen up that dorsal vagus, release its grip, they get more access to their frontal cortex. What happens to them the next time they vote?
Or the next time they have a fight with their spouse.
A fight with their spouse. Or even when somebody new moves into the neighborhood who doesn't mm-hmm. look like them. Mm-hmm. Can they have a more thoughtful and curious experience of their world? Or do they stay in a more in the box, rigid, I only think one way kind of status? So we're really talking about world healing for me.
So I have to tell you, I'm one of these very not woo-woo acupuncturists.
Okay.
And so I sometimes hear things like, oh, we're actually healing the world. I'm like, yeah, kumbaya, whatever.
Just, no, that's why I like this polyvagal stuff.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
it's science. It's not woo-woo.
No, it's although, not.
Although what we find is that the spiritual traditions mm. are actually reflecting what we're finding out in science yeah, about this is, I affect you, you affect me. We're in this together. Our energy fields influence each other.
I'm coming around.
Yeah.
I'm coming around. You know,
I mean,
I love
Kumbaya any minute.
I will be singing Kumbaya. Yeah, it's fascinating. Uh-huh. And uh-huh. I mean, I grew up in a Western culture, so mm-hmm. I can't not consider our Western physiology and our Western science, which has some amazing stuff. Mm-hmm. It's very reassuring to me, especially as we talk about this stuff, like you free up the frontal cortex by pulling the brainstem off of it, right? You get the damn reptile out of the way.
Exactly.
And now the mammal, not just the emotional mammal, but that loving human-type mammal.
That primate kind of mammal.
That primate kind of mammal. Uh-huh. Troublesome primates that we are, but also amazing.
That's right.
Now that can come through more.
That's right.
Yeah.
Transformation is possible.
Damn, we will be singing Kumbaya before long.
Yeah.
It's extraordinary. Yeah. And okay. So maybe acupuncture can heal the world. Uh-huh. Along with a lot of other things.
Along with a lot of other things. We're not the only ones.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, that dorsal vagus, it's important to us. It's not a bad guy. You know, at low tone, our dorsal vagus is what helps our spleen and stomach transform food into chi and blood. Mm-hmm. It's what moves hormones around our body. It's what supports T cell production. You know, I mean, all that kind of behind-the-scenes stuff is all under the regulation of low-tone dorsal vagus. It only has to go into high tone when the ventral vagus can't manage the threat, can't manage the cardiac arousal when it gets too high, and the heart needs protection. Mm-hmm. So, if we're injured and we fight and fight and fight to save ourselves, and we can't save ourselves, it will thankfully put us into a freeze state until some people can come along and can help us get out of the mess we're in. Mm-hmm. So, and in doing that, it slows our metabolism, slows our need for oxygen, for energy resources and so forth, to keep us alive a little bit longer until help can come.
Kind of a suspended animation.
Exactly. Exactly. And it's designed to, you know, come on board, shut things down, but then when the danger's over, to relax and come back into low tone and go back to digesting our gristle.
Right.
So, you know, when we hear the guts move in a treatment, we hear gurgling or burping, or I always tell people I love your farts, you know, that's that freeze that's in the dorsal vagus innervates below the diaphragm. So it innervates the guts. And when that freeze lifts off and allows peristalsis to happen, we're home free. We've changed something in their neurologic capacity.
Well, and it's wonderful that we've got this dorsal vagus, because it does, I mean, it is our parasympathetic response. It allows rest, rejuvenation.
That's right.
And digestion.
That's right.
It's amazing that it has this dual function, that when things get in overdrive, it's like, okay, we're going to put the kibosh on this.
That's right.
To keep things from getting out of hand. Now, I can't remember if we had this discussion in the last time we talked. I have heard other people talk about similar things. J.J. Hadlock talks about this a bit with some of the Parkinson's stuff that she does. Yeah, she talks about people going into a freeze state because something happens, and they never quite come out of it. They find ways of living within it.
That's right.
But that fundamentally will change their brain and their brain chemistry.
Right.
And how dopamine works and all kinds of stuff.
Right.
And until they can come out of that, these people are at risk for Parkinson's.
Right.
One of the things that I remember she talked about, and I've heard other people talk about this, we might have, I can't remember. Uh-huh. I talked to so many people, you know, it's like every week it's somebody new around here. I can hardly keep it straight anymore. But one of the things I've heard folks talk about is that one of the things that happens, like when animals come out of this, they will naturally shake.
That's right. That's right.
And sometimes humans, when something freaky happens, we will do the same. I've had an experience where I sprained two ankles at the same time, and it kind of put me in shock. And as I was starting to like kind of get a grip on things, I was shaking like crazy. I could not stop shaking.
And you needed to shake. And rescue personnel would do well to simply allow people to shake instead of telling people to suppress that urge to shake, because you're throwing off that arousal that needs to get thrown off.
Mm-hmm. So the shaking is super important.
Yep.
What else is going on here with the shaking? Is this part of this polyvagal regulation?
Well,
I think
you go into a massive, clutch brace when something like two sprained ankles happens. Mm-hmm. And then when you begin to realize that you survived it, it kind of does that. It kind of releases on down muscles and tendons and ligaments, and just it shimmers on its way out. And mm-hmm. sometimes it's subtle and sometimes it's gross. Mm-hmm. The other thing I wanted to say about this freeze thing, and it comes back to the beauty of the five elements, because you can have a freeze in a particular tissue or a particular organ. Like, it's one thing to recognize a general trauma response. Like, this person is disturbed. I can see it in a general way. But then how does that help us in designing a treatment? Mm-hmm. If all we see is the general disturbance. Now, obviously, we can start with a kidney adrenal hold is a great place to start with anyone, anywhere, and see as organization starts to come on board what else we see and what else comes up in terms of fine-tuning where we're going to go. But we can also develop skills to notice, well, is their freeze more in their guts or is it more in their muscles?
Mm-hmm.
Is it more in their diaphragm, like in how they breathe? Or is it showing up more in their skin?
Mm.
Skin is a fabulous boundary organ. Protects us, helps us recognize the inside world and the outside world, creates a boundary, tells us a lot about the outside world. I mean, functions the communication of the Po with the lung and the skin, tells us if it's cold or it's hot and what we need to do about it and all that. So if you have a brace freeze in your skin, you may not be able to pick up sensations from the outside world and know how to appropriately respond to them. So, all those correspondences that we all memorized in acupuncture school or have a handy chart to review can be really helpful for how do I understand what's going on with this person, and can I develop a diagnostic framework that's bigger than the thousandth symptoms that they have.
Right, which is so confusing.
It's so confusing.
It can be so confusing.
They're going to have disorganization in every element and every organ. Mm-hmm. So what's the one pair of organs or one element that when I help restore regulation there puts everything else back in place?
Yeah.
That's really our question.
Yeah. Can you give us a case of someone that you've treated in the past that would illustrate how you've looked at, oh my God, it's just a whole confusion and jumble of things here. And then you like tuned into, okay, actually it's this element in this level of tissue.
I'm thinking. It's always a hard question because you don't want to share too much personal information about someone. You don't want someone to recognize themselves,
I understand.
In a thing like this.
So you can mix it up a little bit if you need to.
Yeah.
Or put a couple people together.
Yeah. I think that it's fairly safe to say that uniformly people will be supported by the kidney adrenal hold.
Mm-hmm.
Not ever. In fact, I'm working with someone currently who is not comfortable with touch. I'm not able to touch him. So we're working on boundary in terms of how close or how far away I stand from him and helping him find comfort when I'm a little bit further away, and where's the sweet spot where he starts to feel some measure of arousal, and allow him to feel a little bit of arousal and then come back to comfort. So what we're doing is we're creating that wave of arousal and comfort that's actually looks like the Daiji symbol, mm-hmm. Where there's a rise and fall. We want to create that rise and fall in his nervous system and help it restore regulation to the whole megillah. And that's going pretty well.
that's going pretty well. I can now do moxa on him, and I can and we can play with this, creating this wave as our primary task to create that up and down wave. Mm-hmm. It's one story. I may think of others as we go along.
Okay. Let me ask it another way, too. I'm curious. Sometimes people come in and they got these tendon issues. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of a patient I have right now. She's got this tendon issue. And that makes me think of the wood element, and it makes me think, you know, of liver, or, you know, even perhaps gallbladder, mm-hmm. right? Because those are connected. And then there's, you mentioned skin. So I'm mm-hmm. thinking of some patients I've got now that they kind of had hives come in out of the blue. I'm wondering how you might look at something. Well, let's take hives, for instance.
Yeah. I mean, you never really know if hives is a law of cure reaction to there was something that was quite, you know, much more life-threatening that was happening at an organ level, and it's now pushed out to the skin level. Like, we could be glad that it's hives, you know, and not cardiac disease, you know, that is pushing out. We can sure be glad about that. Something I was just thinking about. We'll have to continue. What were you saying just before?
Oh, about recognizing different issues in different organ systems, and sort of taking that as a clue. Oh, maybe I should work with this organ system to help release whatever trauma may be residing in there. One of the things that I loved about the somatic experiencing that you talked about last time, and that as we look at it through the five phases, is that people can be stuck in different places. Some people are stuck in the water phase. That's some right. might be stuck in the earth phase. Some might be stuck in the metal phase. And if we can see and understand where they're stuck, then we can help free that. Because as you were just talking about, we want to take that traumatic experience all the way through the cycle, and then it can be resolved.
Right.
Not just resolved. If they digest that gristle, now they're more resilient.
That's right. Okay. So this woman comes to me. She complains of a sense of anxiety that's right in her solar plexus, and she calls it her heart. And it gets relief by pressing on it. She presses on it, and it feels better. And I'm thinking, she's yellow. She's wants sympathy. She's singing. She has constipation. There's an awful lot of signs that are pointing me towards the earth. So I'm working with her earth, and I'm also holding her kidney adrenal. And it takes like a few months for us to get to, she nearly died when she was born. Her mother hemorrhaged. They thought she was going to die. They saved her. They saved her mother. But it was nip and tuck.
Mm-hmm.
So now, instead of her blaming herself or feeling like she's broken, or, you know, she can't, she's always anxious, she has a lot of anxiety, like that there's something wrong with her. Now we can name, it's like your patient. Now we can name, there was this imprint.
Mm-hmm.
There was this imprint. And it caused this kind of high tone in her guts, in her dorsal vagus, in order to shut down her heart. So now we know that there's a dynamic here between her guts and her heart that started from day one or from minute one. And we can do things like, I worked with her diaphragm system, her respiratory diaphragm. It's like this boundary between the guts and the heart, right? Yeah. And there was a lot of bracing in there, and it's starting to release that sense of anxiety and tension that's right here where this nerve plexus is, right at about CV14, 15. There's a major nerve plexus there that's influencing everything for her. And, you know, we're also doing some things with some probiotics and supporting her digestive health and, you know, in other ways, and trying to do this kind of circle around the wagons thing where she gets a little bit from the west and a little bit from the east, and she gets some acupuncture and she gets some touch and she gets some context. And
when people start to see the bigger picture mm-hmm. of what they've been through, mm-hmm. does that change things for them?
It changes things a lot. It gives them an answer to a puzzle. Mm. And instead of feeling like there's something wrong with them or they're broken, they feel understood and heard and seen. And they know what they're working with and what they're working on. And I think it makes a world of difference to give people that kind of a context. And always to say, this isn't a life sentence. This is change is possible. Mm. You know, it's like those mice that are living it in what did you call it? Mouse spa?
You said mouse spa, and I said, the Mouse Canyon Ranch. Canyon Ranch for rodents.
Yeah, right. The Mouse Canyon Ranch. Like, we can create Mouse Canyon Ranch for them, and they can actually, this is transformable. It's not a life sentence. That we're hardwired, as much as we're hardwired for that dorsal vagus to command the heart to stop beating in a way that's life-threatening, we're equally hardwired to restore regulation after that has to happen. Mm-hmm. Our bodies are made to do that. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we just need some help.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to belabor the point, but it's the beauty of the somatic experiencing that you talk about.
That's right.
And how we can see this through our view of mm-hmm. the dynamic of the five faces.
Yeah, I mean, I think that somatic experiencing is, you know, it's the premier model for trauma resolution for, that I'm aware of in today's world. And the fact that Peter Levine could recognize these five phases of the self-protective response and that they mirror the five elements, the five phases of acupuncture and Asian medicine just makes for a fabulous opportunity for integrative work. And using the wisdom and the intelligence from both these worlds of science. And
yes, both these worlds of science. I love that. Yeah.
Yeah, that just came to me. I think I'm going to use that again. I like that. it's like they're worlds of science and they're very different, but they're equally valid. Mm-hmm. And when we can bring them together, one plus one is going to equal more than three.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of Zen. No, I guess Zen mathematics is 1 + 1 = 0 because, they're into nothing. But we're talking about a kind of synergy.
That's right.
That is 1 + 1 = more than 3.
The world of opportunity.
The world of 1 + 1 = the world of opportunity.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like that. Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I love that it takes us from someone being broken to simply someone being stuck.
That's right. That's right.
There's a lot of hope.
And honoring their body's inherent wisdom and that their body knows the way out mm-hmm. of this stuckness, that we're not a magician who's going to fix them. We're just helping their body to find their way and honoring their body wisdom with confidence and respect.
Every now and then I have this experience in clinic. And I often feel a little edgy when I say this to people because it's a little bit challenging to their kind of mental framework, I would say. But sometimes people come in, they've got something going on, and I'll sit and I'll listen, and they're going on about this problem, and I think to myself, this is not what's wrong with you. This is what's right with you. That there's something happening, and I'm just not buying that it's the problem. I get it, they've got problems, and I'm not denying that. Uh-huh. And I want to help as best I can. Uh-huh. But sometimes I hear something in what they're saying, and I won't let it go because it doesn't sound like the thing that's uh-huh. broken. It sounds like something that's right. And if we can somehow unfold that rightness, then other things will change. Right. The thing that
so a great question to ask in that kind of a moment is, as you share that with me, what do you notice inside your body? Mm-hmm. And maybe what they notice is either that, like I asked this, I asked this guy once. He was a service member, who was just getting out of the army, and he was being recruited for a very high-level position at the Pentagon. And what he really wanted to do was go back to Wisconsin and raise apple trees and raise his sons, you know? And he was at this very posh meal, you know, high brass, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I said, so as you're considering what they're offering you, and you're in this meeting, what do you notice in your body? And he said, I want to vomit. I want to vomit. I want to puke. I feel horrible. This is awful, you know? And he went on to have this whole conversation with me about, could he write the Dalai Lama and ask for forgiveness? I said, I think you've already got the forgiveness, you know, but I think you sure can write him. And he ended up not taking the job and going back to Wisconsin and raising his kids and growing apples.
Wow.
Because he could get that. See, this is the other risk with this high-toned dorsal. You can lose capacity to recognize the signals from your gut.
Mm-hmm.
Like if your gut is so frozen, you lose that capacity to, I knew it in my guts. You lose capacity to know you're trustworthy, you're not trustworthy. And so you make bad decisions about who to trust and who to not trust. You get into more trauma situations because you've trusted people who are untrustworthy. So you get wounded over and over and over again. And worse yet, you may not be able to recognize when you're hungry, when you're cold, when you're tired, when you need help for whatever reason. And so you'll make bad decisions related to your self-care. So when you don't have what Porges calls interoception, when you don't have the capacity to perceive from your guts, you can't navigate your life well. You can't navigate your life well. So when every time someone is able to recognize a message that comes from their innards, they're healing that capacity for interoception. They're allowing some movement to come into this frozen state of guts and communicate with the world.
Oh, man. You know, we can hear the world, can't we?
We can. Yeah. Yeah.
Have you got some other, like, kick-ass, super helpful questions like this that help people to pause and take that inward look and maybe open up some of this? You just used the word, and I don't know how to pronounce it.
Interoception.
Interoception. Tell us what that means again, real quickly.
So our interoceptive capacity is our ability to know what's happening from the inside.
Mm-hmm.
So it's recognizing, you know, it could be recognizing that I feel anxious, or it could be recognizing that I feel hungry. That's interoception. There's kind of a subcategory called that Stephen Porges developed called neuroception.
Mm-hmm.
Neuroception is our capacity to feel safe.
Oh, wow. That's
to recognize that we're safe. So that kidney adrenal, its job is to recognize both when we're safe and when we're not safe. Because if you can't recognize when you're not safe, you won't make appropriate responses.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can't recognize that you are safe, you
still
also won't
make appropriate responses. Yeah.
Right. But, you know, in our language, when something overwhelming happens, like your guy at birth, mm-hmm. his chi necessarily left his body because mm-hmm. it wasn't safe for his chi to be there.
Yeah, so, and his shen.
Barely
there.
So we can say that his interoception left with his chi.
Ah, okay.
So I kind of think of interoception as a lot like the po.
Mm-hmm.
It's like our animal nature. It's our instinctive nature. It's that communication that's below words. That's our interoception. And whenever we invite someone to say, well, as you say that, what do you notice in your body? Well, I feel a shimmer down my legs. Let's just let you be with that shimmer. And you can ask them, does it go all the way down to your toes? Which toe? You're going to find out what meridian is carrying that shimmer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then you're going to know what meridian you want to support, maybe.
And likewise, it would seem to me, if they come back and go, I don't know, or maybe they actually do have a sense and they go, well, actually, it's like outside my body.
Uh-huh.
Do you have people say things like that?
Well, a lot of people won't know because their interoception has been so damaged that they have no body referencing capacity.
Mm-hmm.
But they may be able to notice that the room somehow feels differently.
Mm.
I noticed that the chair is a little more comfortable, or I'm more aware of the chair that I'm sitting in, or the table. I'm more on the table.
Mm-hmm.
Like they may be able to notice something like that. So the more we can support that, we're actually supporting their chi to return to their body. And when chi is present, healing can happen.
Yeah. And blood flow is better there too.
Blood flow is better there too, because chi and blood, they have that relationship.
They've got that relation, not to mention all the consciousness that's in the blood.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. That's right.
So getting people to...
Yeah, the consciousness is in the blood. Can I say something about that?
Yeah.
Because the heart communicates the arousal to the kingdom of the body via the blood pulse. So it's the blood that carries the message to every cell of the body that it needs to respond because there's a life-threatening situation. So the blood carries that anxiety, that arousal, that message, right? And then when it, and it's supposed to get restored in the liver at night,
mm-hmm.
right? But if we're not sleeping at night because we're too anxious, insomnia being probably the primary signal of a stress response, so then the blood doesn't get to be restored, then the anxiety just continues to live in the system. So another touch technique that can be very helpful, in addition to the kidney adrenal hold, is holding the liver blood.
Oh.
Just put your hand on the liver.
Mm-hmm. On the front or the back?
On the front. I usually do on the front, just right over the rib cage.
Mm-hmm.
And just inviting equanimity and peace into the liver with some loving attention in your hand. And the anxiety will come out of the blood and the heart will be able to shine with more clarity because the blood has been...
It's been restored and cleansed. Yeah.
Restored it to regulation.
That sounds like a simple thing that any of us could recognize and do in clinic. Mm-hmm. Certainly, mm-hmm. I think we'd have several opportunities a week.
Yeah. And actually, anybody can do it, but acupuncturists get to do it with a needle in liver 3 at the same time. You know?
Or liver 8.
Or liver 8. Mm. Or liver 8 would be great. Or even liver 14.
Mm-hmm.
Or 13.
Yeah.
You know? Just to direct the attention just a little bit more.
Yeah. Well, I love this interoceptive idea, this way that we get connected back up with that part of us that does know.
That's
because,
right.
Because we do, even if we're confused and we're troubled, I don't think anyone has ever had a moment where they didn't listen to their gut and then later realized I should have.
Mm-hmm.
And was like, oh yeah, I should have listened to my gut. I mean, we all know this. We all know this is part of our endowment as human beings.
Right. Right. And actually that most of, like something like 80% of the nerves in our gut are afferent, meaning they communicate to the brain. So the brain doesn't have as much influence on the guts as the gut has influence on the brain. So when we override our guts with our brain and say, oh, I can do it anyway,
mm-hmm.
or I thought that guy was a schmuck, but I decided to trust him because of X, Y, or Z. Our guts are usually right, and we should trust our guts.
Are you telling me that if someone calls me shit for brains, that it's a compliment?
Could be. But you get what I'm saying, that the message, like the primary message is center, like is this visceral brain, this belly brain communicates 1,000 things to help us navigate our life.
Absolutely.
Who's safe, who's not safe. It produces our T cells for our immune system. It produces 80% of our neurotransmitters like serotonin to regulate our mood. Like if our dorsal vagus has shut down capacity in our foo, all those functions for serotonin production, T cell production, all those things are going to be influenced.
So it's not just that we can't eat a knockwurst without belching. It, you know, it's bigger than that.
Way bigger. Yeah.
Way bigger.
Including our mood and such. I mean,
that's right.
You know, the incredible popularity of, you know, SSRI drugs is, you know, an attempt to do something about the problems between the gut and the brain communication.
That's
that
right.
Gut-brain communication was there.
That's right.
There wouldn't be a need for those drugs because we've got all of that within our system. We just need to get it from one place to another and have clear communication.
That's right.
Would you say the Chong channel is somehow involved with all this?
I absolutely think so. I absolutely think so. I use it often.
In what ways do you tend to use it?
Mastering a couple points and a hand under the kidney.
Ah, okay. I love how simple our medicine can be at times. And at the same time, profoundly transformative.
Right. And then I probably would finish off the session with a tonification of source points in their element that's their causative factor element.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, look at that. We just burned another hour.
There you go. There you go. Enjoyed myself. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I hope all you listeners enjoyed this as much as we just have.
Indeed.
And I want to remind folks that you've got a fantastic book. If you're interested in treating trauma, this is a great read, both from that, from this, from the points of view of both sciences, Eastern and Western.
That's right.
It's in there. And
the Tao of trauma.
The Tao of trauma. And you're doing some classes too, as well. Is that right?
Yep. I'm starting in October with a 5-session series in Ojai, California, and in Silver Spring, Maryland, two bi-coastal offerings this fall.
That's great. Okay, you're hitting both ends of the country.
That's right. That's
right. Wonderful.
Well, thank you.
Elaine, again, thank you for the conversation. Thank you for your work. And thank you for helping me to open my eyes in clinic to how trauma is, can possibly be part of the picture.
Yeah,
it's so helpful to be able to not have it be invisible.
Well, thank you for your work as well. It's the dialogues you put on geological are so helpful to our medicine to keep it in a thoughtful and reflective zone.
Well, thank you.
Really I appreciate it.
I'm just, you know, I just like talking to people smarter than me. That's all.
You're great.
Thanks again.
All righty. Take care. Bye.